And this is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, NPR. Thank you so much for listening. We're about to get into the local edition, but do want to remind you before we get started that it is our fall fun drive. Thank you to everybody who helped us make the challenge during the news tonight. And the next challenge is, well, ending the fun drive. We're now just have a little more than 2 days ahead of us. The fun drive ends midnight at Friday night. We have not yet made our $50,000 goal. So please, if you haven't given yet, please do give now as we get into the program. Remember, we're waiting to hear from you at WJFFradio.org. That's WJFFradio.org. Or call 845-482-4141 as we get into this program here. Welcome to the local edition, live from Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York. I am your host, Jason Dolan, and thank you so much for joining me tonight. We got a lot of news to get to. And we're going to start where we usually do on a Wednesday, which is checking in with Ruby Rayner of the River Reporter to get the latest news from her. I actually spoke to her just a couple hours ago, earlier this afternoon. And we went over a lot. Healthcare, school funding, and what the candidates have to say about that, and what happened in the Texas township. Here it is. Ruby Rayner, welcome back to the local edition.
Oh, it's great to be here.
So let's start off talking about healthcare, because it's a major concern in our area. And then also health care and health services. It's been a concern of not just the residents, but a recurring topic of discussion in this election season as well. And we have that historically low health data out of this county, where we often rank near the bottom of the state, though that has improved somewhat in recent years. So you've done some in-depth reporting to look at the county's health data from just this year, which is fairly recent. How did you do that, and what did you find?
Yeah, so the health data that's oftentimes that you just referenced comes from the county health rankings and mappings by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and it's done by University of Wisconsin, and they release that county health ranking data every year. And until this year, they would rank all of the counties in New York State and based on their health data. And Sullivan County has historically been, you know, very low, and they've been 61 out of 62 of the counties in New York State, which is what's referred to a lot by, you know, like you were saying, politicians in this election, when they're discussing health rankings for Sullivan County, residents themselves, as well as, you know, nonprofit organizations in the county that focus on health, as this reflection of the state of the health in the county. And this year, the Sullivan County government reported that the county had moved from 60 to 57 in New York State's health rankings as compiled by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation County Health Ranking and Roadmap Report, which is what kind of prompted a deeper dive into what that data says.
Okay, great. So what did it say?
So yeah, so despite the reported jump, it's very clear in rankings that the county's overall health outcomes have not improved, and by some indicators have slightly worsened. So the way that it's calculated is these overall health outcomes, which are length of life, quality of life, which includes, you know, poor health, poor physical health, poor mental health, and the percentage of that much in Sullivan County, as well as additional health outcomes like life expectancy, child mortality. Those are the health outcomes that are being collected, and they're all determined by a long list of health indicators. And these overall health outcomes for Sullivan County have not improved in this year's data, and some indicators have slightly worsened. But the way that that ranking came out, that improved ranking, is because previously the health outcomes were weighted on a statewide scale, like I talked about. So they ranked them and they were on this state scale. But this year, RWJF, the foundation that funds the data collection, they weighted it on a national scale. So there's actually no longer the statewide ranking that's released. And in the release, the Sullivan County Health and Human Services Commissioner, John Little, said that, you know, while they no longer provide these numerical rankings, they calculated the data, and it appears to indicate that Sullivan has risen from what they were at 60th to 57th. But speaking with Kristen Pendo Magundo, she's the data and analytics team lead of the County and Health Rankings and Roadmaps at the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute. She told the River Reporter that it's really difficult to determine an accurate statewide county rank with this year's data because the data has been calculated on a completely different scale. So it would be inaccurate to compare the two. She says a rank created from this year's data cannot be compared to a county rank in the past because the two numbers just have different scales. And that's one of the reasons that they did away with the county rankings, is because there was the possibility that your ranking could improve countywide or move down, not because your health outcomes necessarily improved or worsened, but because a different county's ranking potentially improved or worsened because it was relative on that scale.
You again said that the data shows worsening health outcomes for Sullivan County in 2024 compared to the previous year, but some underlying factors did improve. So what are some of those improvements?
There were 13 underlying health factors that did improve from 2023 to 2024. And some of those health factors included improved food access, a decrease in excessive drinking, a decrease in sexually transmitted infections, an improved ratio of dentists in the population, and an improved ratio of mental health providers. And for context, a ratio of mental health providers has been improving statewide and nationwide and countywide for the past couple of years, so that falls in line, but it has continued to improve. And then another factor, which I thought was interesting, underlying health factor that improved, was the number of mammograms as percentage of the population. And the Commissioner of Health and Human Services, John Little, said the improvement in the ratio of mental health providers to the population, he attributed that as a direct result and of an emphasis on mental health providers that Sullivan County has been working on, and also aligned the improvement factors related to food and physical activity in care as programming from nonprofits like Sullivan 180 and programming from Cornell Cooperative Extension, as well as attributing the improvements in sexually transmitted diseases to work with nonprofit Sullivan Allies Leading Together, or SALT, and also larger public health efforts by the county.
Okay, so those are the underlying factors that improved. What about the underlying factors that got worse?
So there were underlying factors that worsened between 2023 and 2024. And those were adult obesity, access to exercise opportunities, alcohol-impaired driving deaths, and ratio of primary care physicians to population, as well as number of preventable hospital stays, flu vaccination rate, and number of injury deaths. So those were a couple of those underlying factors that worsened. And the worsening of the ratio of primary care physicians and the number of preventable rates is in line with concerns that have been brought up in over the last couple of months. We've talked about on here, and for listeners who maybe didn't hear, there was a recent town hall meeting with the county's largest healthcare provider, Garnet Health, and attendees brought this very exact kind of concern that's reflected in the data about the shrinking number of healthcare providers and services available in the county. And the Commissioner of Health and Human Services, Little, said that worsening ratio of primary care physicians to the population is a concern and something that Health and Human Services is aware of. But looking at these underlying health indicators that determine the health outcomes is where we can deduce a little bit more about why and what's going on and contributing to the overall health of the county.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for going over all of that, especially as we said a couple times there, this is a key ongoing story that we've been covering on air here at Radio Catskill and that many interested parties have been following in the county, just the state of health in this county with all the challenges that we have in such a rural area and across our listening area, Northeast Pennsylvania as well. It's, you know, it's a similar story there. Let's move to some election politics. The last time we spoke, you dove a little deeper with some of the candidates, focusing more on issues than just general getting to know the candidates. And now you've spoken to the incumbent state senator of New York's 51st Senate District, Peter Oberacker, Republican, and his challenger, Michelle Frazier, Democrat. And they're talking about school funding. Can you first tell us a little bit about why did you talk about school funding to them?
Yeah, definitely. So the context around why these candidates' opinions on the subject of school funding is why it's so important, I think, is essential to understand the state Senate and Assembly are like the two bodies that can really influence the governor's budget for the state. And that's where the money, school funding, a lot of that money is allocated. And this past year, schools like Sullivan West School District were prepared to lose $2 million in foundational aid, which was a 17% drop. And that was based on the original first New York State Governor Kathy Hochul's executive budget. That didn't end up going through, but the initial proposal in Hochul's budget cut this provision called Hold Harmless, which basically guarantees that school districts like Sullivan West School District and others across our area will not receive less aid, so their foundational aid that they get from the state, than they did the year before. The provision was intended to offer stability so that districts would not have to face like a sudden drop in funding, even if they've potentially lost students or have some type of surplus in their funding. And ultimately, right, like I said, the governor reversed the provision cancellation at the last minute, but has indicated since that there are going to be plans to update how foundational state aid for school districts is formulated in this year's budget. So it's going to be a conversation. A new state commission has been formed to overhaul the foundation aid formula to fund local school districts. So it's going to be a conversation of elected officials in both the state assembly and the state senate about what this new formula for foundational aid for school from the state in New York is going to look like. And so the reversal, like schools in our area, Sullivan West, like I mentioned, Eldred, they're all looking ahead to this 2025-26 school year in anticipation for what could potentially happen to their school budget. And one other thing, just for a little bit of context, is that a lot of this specific Hold Harmless provision that was threatened to be cut, Robert Lowry, who's the deputy director of the New York State Council of School Superintendents, particularly pointed out that would have hurt rural schools the most because schools like Eldred has lost 43% of its K-12 population in the last 23 years, and the same percentage lost by Sullivan West during the same period. They were going to be impacted by this cut. And so lawmakers, you know, opposing this plan and stopping it was a big influence on why it was reversed. And so I think it's very interesting why voters might be interested to hear how candidates for the 51st State Senate approach foundational aid and want to potentially change and reform it this year.
All right. So that's the background. So what did the candidates said? Did you hear from both of them on this?
Yes. So I spoke with both candidates for New York's 51st State Senate District, Michelle Frazier and Peter Oberacker, and they both basically, bottom line, agree that the school foundational aid formula, which in some cases uses census numbers from 2000 and 2008, it needs to be adjusted. So there's a kind of common understanding between both of them and also many politicians that this formula that exists does need to change. But how it will change slightly differs between the two candidates. So Michelle Fraser said that foundational aid to accommodate the diversity of issues that rural school districts have, which are different from their urban counterparts. She gave the example of the cost of a teacher for a class of 30 versus 15 students. And I'll quote her here. She said, quote, "The reality is you're going to have a higher per pupil cost to educate in smaller school districts. Economies of scale do not apply well in rural communities," end quote. So, the idea that regardless of if you have 15 students in a class versus 30 students in a class, you still need a teacher, and that cost might be higher, but it shouldn't necessarily affect the amount of funding. And she really pointed to having the proper kind of rollout for these changes. So while updating the foundational aid formula, needing to give schools that notice so that they can properly work towards being able to actually meet those goals. So you can't, you know, she's saying you can't have a static formula that doesn't change with communities, but she made this comparison between having a big ship, it's going to take way longer to turn the corner than when you have a little car. So when you're talking about this entire school district, you need to make sure that you're giving superintendents the proper amount of information and the proper amount of time with these provisions to turn that corner of adjusting the way that their foundational aid is received. And she also then also mentioned as her an educator herself that she really believes in having a strong rural voice at the table and wanting to have that voice heard in this conversation. And I'm going to quote her here. She said, quote, "And the reality is that, you know, my opponent isn't always at the table. On occasion, he's missing his seat, and therefore we're missing our opportunity. So that's, for me, one of the biggest issues in thinking about foundational aid is that we've got to make sure that we do not get caught in the process, because rural children need an education just as much as urban and suburban children," end quote. And then moving to incumbent Peter Oberacker, he, you know, in a statement when this was first suggested to cut this hold harmless provision, said that he strongly opposed canceling it and said that it would have negative impacts on schools and their physical stability. He also agreed, right, foundational aid formula needs to change and it needs to be revamped. And he said that he said from the beginning that it should just be totally scrapped and start from the beginning with an updated census and adjusting the, quote, wealth ratio to be more representative of rural areas like Sullivan. So he says that the wealth ratio is part of determining the foundational aid, and in places like Sullivan has been adjusted due to the influx of second homeowners, which aren't what he quotes as a true identification, but affect the foundational aid. And then he also brought up mandates related to the zero emission vehicles by 2035, which is a New York State mandate, and said that the mandate is part of these larger climate goals, but that the cost of those would be a burden to school districts, and that that's all part of this bigger issue of funding for schools. He said that he's not in favor of doing away with hold harmless, but he says, quote, you know, zero emissions buses, let's talk about it. You know, supervisors are looking at all of this eventually, and if they go awry, they're going to have to plan for it in their budgets, and the only way they can do that is in a defensive position, end quote. So those were the two perspectives that they gave on foundational aid and New York State school foundational aid funding.
And that was Ruby Rayner going over the news with me earlier this afternoon when I spoke to her. And those stories are up now at riverreporter.com. That's riverreporter.com. And big thanks, as always, to Ruby Rayner for going over the news with us. And now we've got more news for you here on the Local Edition. But I will remind you, of course, it is still our fall fun drive. And we do need your help, your support. Go to WJFFradio.org. Make your donation there in support of this program and all the great programs that we have for you here on Radio Catskill. Well, Seasoned Gives and Hemp and Humanity are bringing the cannabis community together this week. The third annual Fall Hudson Valley Cannabis Roll Call will take place on Thursday, October 24th. That's tomorrow. Season Gives is hosting the event in Lake Katrine, New York. Radio Catskill's Nia Watson spoke with Tamika Dunkley, executive director of Season Gives, and this is how that goes.
So it's a quarterly networking event. It's a business-to-business event primarily. We really created this to offer a safe space for people throughout the supply chain to network and to get together. The Hudson Valley is a really unique space and place. And because of our uniqueness and our proximity or lack thereof to each other, you can be in the Hudson Valley and be 2 hours away from each other. So this allows a very centralized location for people to be able to come, commune, network, and just, you know, really talk about the important issues going on in cannabis.
I love that you mentioned, you know, important issues going on in cannabis. I want to ask more about the event, but first I'd kind of like to talk about the rollout process from 3 years ago. With the Marijuana Regulation and Taxation Act and the conditional adult use retail dispensary licenses, there were expectations among members of the cannabis community, but the rollout and plan for issuing licenses did not go as planned. Can you talk about the current state of cannabis in New York compared to then?
Here's the reality. So I was on, as many people were, on the forefront of trying to champion not just for the legalization of cannabis and the cannabis industry, but also for social equity, true social equity. And the state had a unique opportunity to invest and reinvest into communities, especially of color, who have been disproportionately impacted by the war on drugs. This was a way for folks to be able to really put their money, their time, their effort, and their energy into a community that has been completely dismantled because of the war on drugs, and specifically cannabis, really. Because if we look at the current opioid epidemic, it's being treated very differently than cannabis and the crack epidemic were treated. And the biggest differentiation is the color of folks' skin. When we talk about communities of color and over-policing, that is really the foundation that we're, as the executive director and as Season Gives, we're coming from. We understand that there is a huge economic opportunity here, you know, the largest one since prohibition. And realistically, those who have paid with their lives and their friends and families' lives and done the most time behind bars should be the ones to now have the equal amount of economic opportunity. Unfortunately, what has happened, despite many people's, intent is not necessarily what it transpires, because I do believe that there was a lot of people with good intentions. You know, despite many people's intent to provide true social equity, it got very muddled and convoluted, partially because it is unconstitutional to prioritize Black and brown people in terms of being able to create an increased economic fortitude. So that's number one. The number two piece of this is that in terms of the rollout itself, there have been challenges every single step of the way, including and up to, you know, funding. And that's probably one of the biggest platforms that I've been very boisterous on. And especially because we represent, we've really fostered primarily women and BIPOC businesses, especially for those who do not typically have access to investment funds, banking funds. And we all know that it's still not federally recognized. So the banking funds are still a challenge just to get a bank account. But it's really trying to invest into those who have never had that access. And they unfortunately still do not have that access. And that has caused a lot of issues, especially, you know, look at CARD. There's hundreds of folks who were recipients of CARD licenses and they still are not open a year and a half, 2 years later. And that is because of the monetary challenges. You cannot say, oh, here's a piece of paper, but you're required to have $500,000 in the bank with people who have never had anything. There is not that type of money in many of these families, especially those who were truly disproportionately impacted. So, you know, unfortunately, the services, and I'm in the technical assistance space, I'm in the space of helping to bridge these gaps. But unfortunately, because I'm in these spaces, unless they're willing to give up a large amount of their company, there's really not much that can be done without very, very, very creative financing tactics. So I'm sorry that to be so long-winded, but, you know, it's a really huge challenge amongst all the other challenges that you see in the media.
Thank you for explaining this. Just to clarify for any listeners who don't know the acronym CARD, it is Conditional Adult Use Retail Dispensary, the licenses. Let's go back to the roll call event. Why are events like these so important now?
Because, you know, unfortunately, there's still so much turmoil. It's so important for folks who are, you know, dispensary owners to be able to have the opportunity to talk to farmers, to be able to talk to micro business owners. It's just a really, really important space to hold. It's just like a chamber of commerce or any type of networking event, but with a different type of energy. And that's very important that we bring a safe environment where everybody feels welcome, no matter, you know, color, gender, you know, sexual orientation. We want to make sure that everyone feels accepted and appreciated and destigmatized. And that's a really important aspect of why we do these roll calls as well.
And turnout. How has turnout been in past roll calls, and how do you project the turnout to be for this upcoming one?
We always get consistently, you know, 150 or so people in the room. People drive for an hour and a half sometimes. We've had people come from the city in New Jersey, Massachusetts, just to do business in New York. And that's the beauty of being at 11 Lohmeyer Lane in Lake Katrine, is that we are an hour and change from Westchester, from Massachusetts, from the Poconos, from, you know, we're like an hour and change from Albany, you know, and from the city. So we are truly centrally located, which makes it so beautiful to create this space that is not, you know, divided by these imaginary lines that we have upstate versus downstate versus, you know, all that. You know, it's 10 minutes from the train station. If people come from the city, they can hop right on that train.
With all of that in mind, what do you hope attendees will gain from this event?
Well, I'm happy to report that people are doing business that stems from the roll call. There are hundreds of thousands of, if not more than that, of transactions that are happening between people who consistently come. So we have our group of folks that consistently come and find huge value in it. We usually generally have about 50% of the room that's new and 50% of the room that's consistent, and it alternates. It's really phenomenal. That is really the biggest thing, is we want people to be able to do true business transactions. Cannabis industry is very different. You know, the culture is very different, but it's still business. Right. And so we just really want to foster and support that in any way we can.
And is there anything else you would like to add about this event or any upcoming events or programming?
Well, Season Gives, we focus on really empowering, especially women in the BIPOC community, through economic pathways. So that's one of the things that has sparked our involvement in cannabis. The roll call is this October 24th that starts at 6 p.m. And to visit HudsonValleyCannabisRollCall.com for more information, to buy tickets. And I hope to see folks out there at our next roll call. If you're involved in the cannabis industry, if you're thinking about being involved in the cannabis industry, I would love to invite folks to a series of events that we do for workforce development. It's free of charge. The first one is going to be October 29th at 6 p.m. That's going to be on the SUNY Ulster campus. And you can visit seasongives.org for that. And then there's going to be one at the Kingston Library at 6 p.m. on November 14th as well. Everybody can see more updates on our events page at seasongives.org, because we do not just cannabis, but many other things.
Thank you so much for all of this information you've shared with us today. Tamika Dunkley from Season Gives, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
In Liberty, I'm Nia Watson for Radio Catskill.
And thank you so much, Nia, for that report. That's going to do it for the local edition tonight. I've been your host, Jason Dole. Thanks also to Ruby Rayner for giving us all the news. And thank you for listening. We'll be back again tomorrow night to do it again. And thank you to everybody who's been supporting us at WJFFRadio.org. That's WJFFRadio.org. And you can make your donation there now as well. We thanked a couple people earlier, such as Nick. But I didn't mention his comment. He says, love the station. Listen on my way to and from work during my lunch break. Thank you so much to Nick for saying that. And at the end of All Things Considered, we also heard from Anonymous helping close out that challenge who said the employees of WJFF are tough as nails. I've lived in various parts of the U.S. and you guys have the most difficult begging duty of any public radio station that I'm aware of. So thank you to Anonymous for acknowledging the effort that we put in to keep this station funded. You can join that effort yourself right now. You don't have to do any of the begging. You can just do a little bit of the responding. Whatever you have to give, please do give it now. Go to WJFFradio.org to make your donation. Hey, Retro Cocktail Hour comes up at 7 o'clock. We're going to be making cocktails in the studio, okay? But first, we've got the Daily, so be listening for that as well. This is Radio Catskill.